Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Power Hungry Podcast. I'm Robert Bryce. On this podcast, we talk about energy, power, innovation, and politics. And I'm pleased to welcome back my friend, Emmett Penny. He is the editor of Grid Brief. Emmett, welcome back to the Power Hungry Podcast for your third appearance. Welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, you've been on the podcast before. You know the drill. Guests introduce themselves. You have 60 seconds. Go.
Okay.
So, I'm timing you now.
This I know time. You're timing me, man. Quit eating into my time. So I'm the editor in chief of a daily energy newsletter called Grid Brief. I spend the rest of my time looking into the history of American energy infrastructure, particularly the grid, and writing about that and cultural issues like what to do about environmental apocalypticism. And I also run the Nuclear Barbarian Substack, which is mostly a podcast and every once in a while has some of my writing on it. So that's me.
Great. It was less than 60 seconds. So attaboy.
Under the wire.
Environmental apocalypticism. There's a lot of syllables there.
Yeah, I'm surprised I got that one out. As I started on that word, I was like, uh-oh, this could go any way by the time I finish saying this.
What is it and why is it so attractive? Because we see that a lot. Let's start there. I want to talk about the grid and a lot of other things, but let's start with that. What environmental apocalypticism? Talk about that. Why is it so attractive? What is it and why is it so attractive?
Yeah. So, I think people are, I would assume if they listen to Power Hungry, they have seen stuff like, I joke that, the climate apocalypse is like nuclear fusion. Every year, it's 10 to 20 years away, and that's, I think, a talking point. It's fallen a little bit less out of favor now, but is still there. I mean, I think the New York Times just interviewed the geographer and writer Andreas Malm, who is infamous for writing the book How to Blow Up a Pipeline, which inspired a very bad movie of the same title. And it's the idea that we are causing so much destruction to the environment and incurring so much extreme weather through climate harm, I guess is a phrase they would use, that it's going to endanger our life here on Earth at a massive scale.
Right.
And I think that's attractive for a few reasons. So, first of all, I think people have a crisis of meaning in their lives, but sort of pervasively across the developed world. And that manifests for different people in different ways. I think one of the more popular ways is the idea of climate apocalypticism, because it furnishes your entire life with sort of ethical ordering principles and things to do. Even what grocery bag you choose to take home,
right,
or don't take home, suddenly is freighted with this ethical weight it didn't have before. And it becomes something around which you can order your life. And the crisis of meaning, I think, is really a crisis of ethics. People feel like they don't have a common fund of operating principles around which to orient their lives. And our political system, a liberal democracy, has many, many benefits, but one of its downsides is that it doesn't tell people what the meaning of their lives is. So that's a great opportunity if you're intrepid and you want to do that, or you emerge from a religious community that's already helping you do that. But if you are secular, sort of deracinated, rootless a little bit, then you're going to need something else. And so people glom onto that. I will also say that there are also some historical elements to it that are really important. It's not like we're the first people to invent the apocalypse as like a North Star around which to conceive of the meaning of our time. The Holy Roman Empire did that. The idea was that when the Holy Roman Empire collapsed, so the world would end. That would be the eschaton. That would be the end of everything. You can imagine their disenchantment and surprise when that didn't pan out, So it also seems to be somewhat of just a human tick. But I think it's dangerous because I don't think living in a state of crisis permanently is psychologically healthy for anybody. I think it's clear that it has, studies have been coming out, a deleterious impact on youth,
right,
who feel like they have no future.
Right.
You know, so I think it's destabilizing. I think what people want out of it is a certain type of motivation, but what they actually get out of it is a sense of isolation and, you know,
nihilism, right? There's no meaning for our lives because we're facing this apocalypse. And I like, but I,
right.
I, crisis of meaning, crisis of ethics. As you're talking about this, I'm also, you know, to me, as I think about this, because I think it's a really interesting set of discussions, right? About and ideas around why are we at this point in our culture? And I see this rise of this in environmentalism, climatism, happening concurring with this decline in church going, decline in traditional religious belief. Mm-hmm. Does that rhyme with what you think about this? Through the loss of the church in a lot of family life, or the centrality of faith and traditional religion, particularly for younger people, and that's been replaced by this need to believe in climatism and the overlap of, I'm not the first to point this out, is very similar, very obvious in terms of the idea of sin, and we've sinned and we have to repent, and if we don't, we're going to all burn in hell, right? There's a very similar, mm-hmm. a lot of overlap here. But is that decline in traditional religious belief? Do you think that is part of what's at play here?
Yeah, I could definitely see that being part of it. I think one thing I'd want to avoid in making that claim is that there's a one-to-one replacement level.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, you know, and by that I don't just mean like population-wise one-to-one, like the exact same people who are living in without the church or the people who are interested in climate apocalypticism, though I do think there's probably a big overlap in that Venn diagram. Right. But all just the ideological framework of environmentalism is, I mean, way less rich, way less coherent, you know, and doesn't actually have any sort of, I would say, aspirations beyond mere survival. I think that's one of the most depressing parts of it. It is a world without flourishing. I think it's the sort of the political vision of insects. You know, the best you can do is survive.
Right. Well, that's it. I thought about it in a similar way that there's this, it's a catastrophist cult with little opportunity for redemption, right? That is the, in the Christian ethos, right? It's, well, you will be redeemed, right? If you comport yourself properly, you'll go to heaven and there's a reward for you, right? If you believe mm-hmm. and you act in the right way. Whereas with the climatism, it seems the overriding kind of view is, well, we're just screwed. And, you know, we can only...
Well, it can never end, right? That's the important thing about the climate crisis, is the climate crisis can't ever end. It's just psychologically, structurally, it can't. They can't solve the problem they're trying to figure out.
Right. Or if it does, we're all living in with 40 acres and a mule. When we've gone back to the civilization has halted, or modern civilization has halted, right? Jumped ahead here. But what do you mean when it can't end? I don't understand what you're saying.
So if we see it, so I guess the major claim I'm making here is that it's not actually about the environment or climate. It's about filling the hole of meaning and ethics.
Uh-huh.
And because it's doing that, this problem can't ever be solved. Not because people don't want to solve it, not because they aren't sincere, but because solving it would destroy their world.
That belief, well, the God-shaped hole in our hearts, right? That I don't know who was the one who came up with that. Well, I heard Jonathan Haidt use it, but I don't think he was the one who originated it, right? But there's... You can't ever cure this, because if you do, then there's no other belief system to replace it.
Yeah. I mean, what's there?
Yeah. But at root, it's that we humans are bad, that we humans have overstepped, that we've left the garden, right? That we've done too much. We lived too well, and we're going to have to pay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm reading E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful right now. And I mean, he's basically very clear on that. I mean, that book is a very, like, sort of shockingly culturally conservative book in some ways. Like, really what he's asking for is a return to more ancient wisdom and ancient ethics. What he wants is an economy that has, you know, machine parts and tools that are at the human scale, because he sees that is more convivial for human liberty and things like that. So to me, like, he's not even solving the resource scarcity or pollution problems he's talking about. He's really trying to solve problems for people's lack of meaning and guidance, and also for certain dehumanizing aspects of work, quote unquote, or whatever. You know, I think that the best way to look at how the environment gets treated here, and this isn't true for every single person who participates in environmentalism, obviously. I don't want to paint with too broad a brush or be too unfair, but I think that the concerns about climate or the environment or whatever are basically just like justificatory window dressing to add weight to what they're really trying to solve, right? And the reason that they pick something like climate or whatever is because it's in the language of authority in the secularized developed world, which is the language of science. Mm. Now, it might be scientism.
Right.
That's fine, right? We can make that distinction, but that's still the lingua franca, right? That's the coin of the realm. That is what we see as the major adjudicating ideology for whether something is true or false. So you can't say, I think through the revealed truth of the Bible that life ought to be ordered this way, or, you know, some other, pick any other, you know, major religion.
Right.
What you can say is the science is in.
And it's not denied, and you cannot be denied. And if you deny
it,
it
can't be denied because it's the truth.
Right. Yeah. Because it's the ultimate truth. But isn't it then the scientist is replacing the priest, right? It's still the same kind of top down kind of idea. No.
Yeah. Well, they're being sort of, what is the phrase? Press ganged into the priesthood. You know, I mean, there are some activist scientists, but a lot of them, some of them that I've talked to don't want to be in that role. That's not how they see what they're doing. They understand that that's not what science is, and that's not science's job. Actually, it can't do that, right? You can't derive an ought from an is in that way. And they're very careful about that. So what I think is interesting is that it basically says the scientists are saying this, and it's not clear to me that, like, first of all, the scientists are really saying some of these things. They're making empirical claims about the world, and then people are deriving these things from them and then wanting to borrow, you know, the truthiness of science as people feel it, you know. So I think it's a very puzzling and bizarre modality of thought that seems to mostly make people incredibly sad and scared, which I can only imagine doesn't lead to state-of-the-art decision-making at scale.
Nicely underplayed there. I think does not lead to optimum outcomes, but still at root is a requirement for some kind of authoritarian overview, right? Or authoritarian action, right? To not allow you to have a gas stove, not allow you to have any a Ford pickup with an internal combustion engine. You have to have an electric vehicle. These are in fact mandates, right? For in the state of California, you know, these other things that are underway. But I'm glad to explore that some, because I know you come at you're now an energy writer, I would say, and in editor of Grid Brief, but you come to all of this from a humanities great books classics standpoint, right? That's your education.
That's right,
and your history. So your understanding, your approach to it is very different, I think, from a lot of other writers. I come with my own background in fine arts as well, but, you know, but I've been at it a while, and so I can kind of talk the language. But let's get back to Grid Brief. And you've been doing this now for how old is the publication? 2 years?
Yeah. God, is it 2 years already? Yeah, it's about to be 2 years. We started when the Ukraine war began, like a week before.
So February, so that's 2 years ago, just about. So, and you were last on the podcast in, May 31st of 2022. So, but what have you've been editing it for a while, and you and I talked about this before we started recording, thinking about electricity, and I've written a book about it. I thought about it a lot. I talk about it. I, you know, lecture on it. But I still don't feel like I understand it very well. I mean, I say that very with not false humility, but real humility, because it's so incredibly complicated. How do you view your own education in your editing this publication, and an authority, right? Or you're presenting yourself as having some authority. Do you feel like you're starting to understand it? How do you view your education if you're on a scale of 1 to 10 and you know everything and you're at 1 and you're just a neophyte? What number would you ascribe to yourself, put to yourself?
Dude, maybe 2 at this point. I don't know. I mean, I think
I'd maybe be 3, you know, 3, maybe yeah. 4, right? Because it's just so big and vast and so incredibly complicated.
That, I mean, it also makes you incredibly skeptical of people who are acting like they're tens. You know, I think that's the main thing. What's one of the main benefits I've gotten from working on it is I'm like, well, I don't know like what that situation is, but I know that that guy can't be right about what he says that it is, you know, like that's been helpful. I will say that, you know, when I got sober, that was an incredible lesson in spiritual humility. And I will say that working at Grid Brief, which is a news digest for the most part, you know, we do some other stuff over there too. And I do the whole thing lock, stock and barrel, you know, every day, is that it has been intellectually humbling at the same level. You know, I think I went into this at the start of the Ukraine war. And one of the things that a lot of people sort of in our orbit were saying, and I think I also said this, myself, is like commodities are back, commodities are king, energy runs everything. Like, and that's still true. I don't want to say that those things aren't important, but I think I overdrank from that cup. You know, I did that, if I'm going to be completely honest, is I sort of bought into that narrative because it made up for my lack of knowledge in economics.
Mm.
And I was like, well, here's a domain I already know something about and I can grab onto it. And there seems to be this crisis where people are making stupid decisions about energy. And that's true. That did happen. And all these unforeseen consequences are happening. What if this is sort of the master key to understanding all of this? And in watching the way that, you know, Germany did a lot of fuel swapping to coal and all sorts of things, you know, some economists did some great work on that that disproved certain things that I had really believed were going on in the German economy, I realized that I basically just don't know anywhere near as much as I thought, and that I was sort of covering up for a lack of knowledge in a different domain by, I think, being overconfident. And some of that stuff, when you're writing in public or when you're, you know, doing any of this stuff, you have to learn real time, and that's painful.
Right.
Right. Like, that's your name in the byline. It doesn't mean that I think I misrepresented reality, but I think anybody who's,
it's not necessarily that you misrepresented, it's that you didn't, the understanding wasn't quite enough. You weren't quite,
right.
You weren't,
it wasn't
quite,
refined
you were,
enough.
You were kind of right, but not fully right. But I didn't follow you in terms of what you're describing your journey here and understanding or increasing your understanding, but I didn't quite follow you that you believe that the commodities were everything and instead it was more the inability of the system to flex or inability of the system to react.
I think I just didn't really appreciate what price signals do, right? If I'm just going to be like really rock bottom on that, I didn't understand like what type of information a price signal is, like how it coordinates things, like how it can ration things for you, how it can inspire different types of human cooperation and innovation or all of these things, you know, and the idea that I just by looking at the energy flows, I could sort of decision tree out how everything was happening from there was naive, you know, like I'm almost a little embarrassed that I saw that now that I am a year later. I'm sure I'm thinking things this year that next year I'll be like, oh my God, I can't believe all that. I mean, I was talking to you yesterday and we were talking about problems in the RTO system.
Right.
And I said, you know, Robert, when I'm looking at the TVA, give its warning, you know, it seems like it's out of the woods here at this time today, January 17th, about 11:30 a.m. You know, but last night they were worried that they were going to have the same problems they had last Christmas.
Right.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, I'm starting to wonder if the problems between the RTOs and some of the monopoly utility areas aren't similar due to the nature of pipeline governance and how the gas system works, because now everybody's so dependent on that. And that's something I would have never said 2 years ago when we started. Brief like that. And that's just because I have been paying attention to like generation data and all of this stuff, you know, every single day. So I think it's also made me have a better doubt mechanism.
Yeah.
And I've also really learned how to be more neutral in my coverage. which is something I didn't know how to do because I came into GridBrief being an opinion writer and an essayist and all of these other things. I had to, through just getting my reps in, figure out how to tone all of that down.
Right.
And to also be really measured in the claims that I make. You know, I rarely make hard claims anymore. Yeah. Because I mean, it's daily and I don't know. I don't know. And there are times when I don't know what I don't know. And I think the other thing that I've learned in doing GridBrief is that there are many people who probably learned the lesson that I learned. And there are also many who kind of refuse to learn that lesson.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, who refuse to take in new information and retool their thinking at all. You know, like, for instance, I'll just say it, Sammy Roth over at the LA Times just wrote this thing about how fracking is more dangerous for birds.
Yeah. And
I mean, you know, like, how many times is this guy going to write a piece like this? How many times is he going to write like a halfway, you know, like maybe nuclear is okay piece while like the California grid is melting down? What did California see as a spot price for like several hours the last couple mornings at the beginning of this week? Over 1,000 per megawatt hour, almost 1,500 for a few hours. And we all know why that's happening. So, you know, I don't know. You know, I'm not saying I'm better than anybody. I'm saying that there are people who are even maybe worse than me in some regards. I'm sure some of Samry's coverage is great. I don't read everything he does because I don't have an LA Times thing. So I'm not going to totally throw him under the bus. He seems like a sharp guy who's very nice in a lot of ways. So sorry, Sammy. I doubt you're listening, but just want to make sure I'm not like picking a fight, you know?
I know. Well, I saw that on Twitter. Oh, fracking is more dangerous to birds than wind turbines. Okay, well, I've written about, I mean, just a quick... I started writing about the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and oil field bird kills more than 30 years ago. And so I have a long history on that. And it's just this, the demonization of the oil and gas industry and kind of, oh, well, it's only a few birds when the wind industry kills them. And yet it's all the oil. I don't know. I just, I find it all very tiresome. And
dude, anybody who looks at like the black box of how they count take, right? That's what they call killing a bird for. I know you know that, but just for the audience, for wind turbines, anybody who looks into that knows that it's totally skewed in the industries. Like, if anything's regulatory capture, it's that.
Right. And they they're
basically like, well, we hired a guy to walk around in a circle at the base of the turbine and he didn't find anything.
Yeah.
So if Frank didn't find anything, how could we kill a bird?
Yeah. And Frank was out there. I mean, we sent him out there twice over the last 5 years. So, I mean, they're,
what are you even worried about? Plus we got a permit for it anyway. So.
I know I can. Well, my cynicism about that is can scarcely be overstated. I just I find that whole. Oh, I'm a longtime critic of the wind business, proudly so. I don't like them. I'm sure they don't like me back. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But that's well known. I don't have to repeat that. So, well, when you think about the one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the podcast, you haven't been on in a long time. But also, as you know, at the end of the month, January 31st, the docuseries, and you're one of the stars of the new docuseries, Juice, Power, Politics, and the Grid. And it's a 5-part docuseries, and you are, you know, you told you you've created some fans already. The series isn't out, and people are already saying, "Oh, that Emmett's great." What if you think back about, I mean, we talked a little bit about GridBrief and your own education in terms of thinking about energy and writing about energy. Are there a couple of any takeaways, things? I mean, you talked about this, about the need to be more humble, right? And have a more humble approach to it. What else have you learned? What else can you say now definitively that you couldn't say maybe 2 or 3 years ago? Or what are the lessons that you think you know now when it comes to, let's just say, the electricity and the grid? What can you say definitively that you know today about it?
I think what I can say definitively about the grid, that's a really good question. Okay, so I think the thing that I didn't really fully appreciate, right? So we all read Meredith's book, and Meredith makes a great point about what things like production tax credits do.
Right, the distortion.
Right. It wasn't until I read people like Travis Fisher, shout out Travis, and you know, an economist friend, Matt Kelly. I don't know if he's listening, but thanks, Matt. And through conversations with them, what I really realized and saw, it was sort of like I didn't have the words for it until I read Dan Lee's testimony last year, where he says, if you're going to make the price signal the means by which you do resource allocation, and then you distort that price signal you're going to get distorted resource acquisition. So in other words, if you say it's free or better to build wind and solar, and you get a whole bunch of wind and solar as a result, that is not going to be adequate resource sourcing to keep the lights on. And it's just axiomatic. There's no way around that.
Right.
That's just how it is. And I don't think I would have seen with as much clarity. And again, this has to do with like the price signal stuff I talked before. I think once I sort of like put that all together and sort of understood the way that that process can work in greater detail, just by having covered this, I really understood what a danger that is. So that's a really vicious cycle.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because this is something we we focus on in the docuseries about the amount of the production tax credit, investment tax credit, the amount of money that is flowing into these different, I will call them in some cases, just flat the speculators, right? But some of the are the incumbent utilities, some are independent power producers, some are just, you know, they are speculators, right? And I call them climate change carpetbaggers, right? But that ability of the, their ability to then build a piece of infrastructure, whether it makes sense in any given location versus another location, right? Does Iowa really need another solar project, or is it just because you can get the land and the interconnection there? There's no overriding sense of what is good for the entire system. Instead, it's only that one that, as Charlie Munger says, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome, right? So, but that distortion of the grid is now, this is one of the key issues we have to deal with, right? Because we're seeing these premature closures of coal plants, and the goal of many of these NGO and climate activist groups to close existing natural gas plants, as well as all the existing coal plants. So we're seeing this massive disruption or massive influx of new infrastructure into the resource mix with no understanding of what this might mean over the long term. And that, I'm just saying, I'm making this what's obvious, I think an obvious point, but it's what I think builds on what you're just saying, that you have all these incentives. So what now, look what we're doing. We're going to have resource adequacy problems. Am I restating what you are making?
I think that's it. And I think I see that more clearly now. And I also would say that sort of my level of like the detail of my knowledge is more refined. You know, I've sort of, I've upgraded from like fork to spork, you know, like I can do a little bit more with my same dumb tool, you know, that's been my trajectory.
I like that. You've upgraded from fork to spork. That's great. So you can eat soup now with a fork. That's
right.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I can do
a little bit more. So, and, you know, let's use one example, right? So Elon Musk, one of his companies, maybe it was Tesla or his solar company that I can't remember the name of, released that report. I know that you wrote something about it where he was just like, here's what transmission we need.
Oh, yeah. You know, Energy master plan for all or something. Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. And I was just like, okay, but this assumes that there's a level of interconnection within these areas that I know doesn't exist. And I was like, oh, I know that doesn't exist now.
Yeah, right.
You know, I was like, it's not just that this is a crazy idea. It's just that there's like a whole piece of the territory missing on this map that invalidates this entire thing before it ever gets started. So it's stuff like that, right? And that's sort of being a two who can tell who's not a 10.
And we're not talking about physical looks here. We're talking about mental capacity, understanding.
Right. Yeah.
Grid.
Yeah.
Because, well, you mentioned Dan Lee's testimony. I'm sorry. I didn't know what was that.
James Danley.
Oh, James Danley's testimony. I forgive me. I misheard. Right. Because his testimony was, and he, for, if you don't know, he was the former FERC. I think he is the former FERC commissioner.
Yeah,
I don't know if he's
now,
off the FERC
as
now.
Of Jan 1.
Right. But he just said flat out in his testimony to the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee in May of 2023 that we are going to face a serious grid reliability problems because we're incenting too much construction of weather-dependent generation, solar and wind. And it was very declaratory. I mean, just with no blinking, no hedging whatsoever. But can you follow on that? And what else about that? You cite that as something kind of pivotal in your thinking about how you look at this. Why was it so important?
I think because it solidified some of my thinking. I would say like before, right? So if you read This is, if you read Plato's Republic, one of the things that gets talked about in the latter half of the book is the difference between like knowledge and right opinion, right? And he sort of puts it on a sliding scale. There's sort of opinion way out on the left, and there's knowledge way out on the right. And right opinion is pretty close to knowledge, but it's not the same thing, right? You're correct. You might be correct for not the best reasons, or you're just lucky that your opinion is correct. And then knowledge is when you're like, okay, I've like ascertained that this thing is really fundamentally true. Like I said, axiomatically, it's almost like the Pythagorean theorem. Mm-hmm. You're like, well, given these, this thing happens, right? Like this is just, it's not negotiable in this way. You would need like a whole different level of like assumptions or an entirely different geometry to generate a different thing. And I think that that was sort of the maneuver that I made there. Whereas I had some sort of like right opinions. And now I'm like, okay, so it seems like the major governing issue for the RTOs is what to do about subsidies. And I'm not saying that we should just have like, you know, ZECs or whatever, like zero energy credits as a replacement for renewable energy credits or
right.
PTCs or whatever, so that we can include nuclear. You know, my favorite one is I'm like, I think the only way that this works, actually the only way that this will work is without subsidies. Like the monopoly areas are their own thing and they have their own incentives.
Right.
But if we're going to run this market, it has to be subsidy free. And is it possible in the governance model that we have created for these RTOs to actually do that? And if the answer is no, then it's going to fail.
So if I'll rephrase what you just said, that the by putting the thumb on the scale, the investment tax credit, production tax credit for solar and wind, that they're so completely distorting the restructured markets or the deregulated markets that those markets will fail.
Yeah. You know, and all markets fail at some point, right? Like that happens in life. You know, there's no perfect market where those things never happen. You know, only in different like economic models do they not fail, you know, and that's because, you know, history is iterative. So, you know, at what scale they fail or what types of problems they are, and then how that failure is interpreted are going to be the very interesting things, right? So I wrote a piece for Grid Brief towards the end of last year where I think it was called The Thing That Scares Me the Most. And I talked about, and you've written about this, the FERC and NERC report on Storm Elliott and the hundreds of thousands that could have been left without gas in New York. And I said, obviously, the human toll of that freaks me out. Obviously. Like that, you don't even have to say that. I was like, what scares me additionally, like in a deeper way, keeps me up at night, are the second and third order things that fall out of that. And because I participate in the media business now, I get this. Where New York, liberal city, media headquarters of the world, especially news media, right?
Right.
All you're going to hear if something like that happens, if the gas system fails, is climate, fossil, climate.
Right.
For the media.
In that order, climate, fossil, climate, right?
Yeah. And that's the only way they're going to do it. And they're going to say, we just need to electrify everything.
Right.
And then that'll shift the burden onto an already gas reliant and fragile electricity system, without really solving any underlying redundancy issues or things like that, or any, you know, like incentives issues in pipeline contracts or how all of that works, you know, all the nitty gritty in there, which I'm only just beginning to understand. And the blame
shifts onto the corporations, right? It's Con right. Ed failed us. Con Ed failed us. The pipeline companies, they didn't do it. You know, it's the fault of the energy deliverers, not the policy that was behind all of this. Because
and you'll see that over and over again.
Yeah.
And you'll see that over and over again, right? So, you know, like if the power market fails after that, it's going to be the same thing. So it's like, how do we break out of this cycle? And honestly, sometimes the RTOs are not being helpful. You know, like MISO put out the other day, like, oh, we had record wind output. And it's like, well, yeah, you had record wind output right before it got super cold and demand increased. Wind died down and coal and natural gas ramped up to save it, you know? So who cares if you set the record? Like that was before game time, you know? It's sort of like, well, I'm the best during practice. It's like, good for you. We're in the playoffs, you know?
Reggie Jackson is Mr. August. No, you want him to be able to hit home runs in October.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You're great. I'm glad you hit a bunch of home runs in August. That's great. I love August, nice and hot, you know, but in the World Series, when it's chilly and you're in the ballpark and it's strike two, we need you to hit a home run right now so we can win the game. But the failure, though, let's talk about the idea of what failure is, because one of the things that motivates me and one of the reasons why I did this docuseries, and I've said this before, is Winter Storm Uri, where I got blacked out here in Austin for 40, Lauren and I did, for 48 hours. And, you know, I didn't suffer hardly. We hardly suffered, right? We have a natural gas connection, so we could cook. We had hot water. We could take a shower. We had a nice fireplace. We could move the bed in that living room. You know, it's okay. Well, we're kind of camping in the living room. You know, worse things have happened to me, right? I'm not sleeping outside. I'm not Daniel freaking Boone here, right? You know,
we're right, okay. Right.
But it made me understand the fragility of the system, right? And it made me understand just what the problems are. But back to the idea of the failure, it seems to me the idea of the failure is not just that we have a catastrophic loss of gas or catastrophic loss of power. It's also that the failure results in excessively high prices. And that seems to me that's one of the things that's at play now, particularly in California. And Isaac Orr and Mitch Rowling just did a great report on this, talking about the price increases, that the failure is of this system now as a system is to deliver cheap, abundant, reliable power, right? And the costs are going up. So does that ring true to you, that the failure is part of what the failure is, the failure of the policymakers to understand the impacts of what their policies are to the consumer?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is a huge disconnect between, okay, so you and I, you've been covering this for longer than me. You rated yourself a 3. I rated myself maybe even arrogantly at a 2. Where do we think the average American policymaker is at?
-5.
Right. And then where do we think, and hey, look, I don't want to go around saying they're all stupid or whatever. I don't know them.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is it took me this amount of work to get where I am and I'm barely anywhere.
Yeah.
And then where do we think somebody who is lobbying on behalf of their extremely climate focused, not really physics focused in terms of a power system, NGO is?
Right.
You know, so I don't want to say like all these people are evil or stupid. What I'm saying is like this stuff is really hard to get to know.
Yeah.
Understanding the consequences of it is equally hard, if not more. And then the other thing is you don't have good incentives for taking your time to figure it out, because we're in that, to bring it back to the beginning of our discussion, crisis thinking.
Yeah.
So it keeps us and inhibits us from actually considering that stuff. And that to me is a really frustrating trajectory. And I don't know how to like fully fix that problem. People are busy and this is complicated.
Yeah.
You know, like you can't, it's hard to soundbite a lot of this stuff because it just doesn't work that way. And if you do soundbite it, you're almost doing like equally bad misrepresentations.
Right.
As your opponents, you know, that's really tough. It's a tough spot to be in.
Yeah. Well, and the complexity, I mean, just to talk about that a little more, is that and you have the RTOs and the ISOs, right, which sit over the top of a lot of these regions. And then you have the regulated markets, like in the Southeast and so on. And then you have the 50 state public utility commissions. You have 800 or 900 cooperatives, 2,000 publicly owned utilities, 200 investor-owned utilities, maybe 180 investor-owned utilities, the public power entities, Bonneville, TVA, et cetera. I mean, the complexity of the system, it truly is staggering. I mean, it just is staggeringly complicated. Then you got the transmission companies, you got and somehow, and I wrote about this on my Substack, I published it today on the, you know, trying to explain the electric grid in 10 charts. But somehow it all works. I mean, it just seems if I step back, if you step back, I guess I'll ask it this way. Are you surprised it all works, given how complicated it is?
Yeah, well, and especially since I've, you know, spent a lot of time to figure out what the history of it is in America. Yeah,
right.
It's really amazing that it works. And it was all ad hoc. You know, like, so once you, here's a great example.
Right. There was no central planning to make the entire US grid. It all just kind of evolved into, and we're going to just connect together. And now we're all connected together. Well, how may? That's crazy.
Right. So once they get high voltage alternating current transmission, and once they get bigger turbines, they can do even better load balancing across areas, right? They can serve more people, and they can even do, they can power pool a little bit, right? So the industry is already power pooling in, you know, by the like 1920s in certain ways,
and
you know,
wheeling, just because wheeling power from one area to another. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. 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 It, just because it's easier. However, the road there is really messy because people didn't have electric clocks for a really long time. So you didn't know if everybody was literally like, if they had their watches set to the same time you did, there was no way to tell.
Right.
If one station had the same time, like you could be in the same time zone and it could be off, right? Like,
yeah.
So it wasn't until electric clocks were refined that balancing issues started to become more easily resolvable. And then they turned around and sold the electric clocks to their constituent, to their customers, so that people were using electricity all of the time, even when they weren't at home. Right. So talk about a self-licking ice cream cone.
Yeah.
Know? So right. I think, so
hey, that's my term.
Things,
you know, you love music.
Yeah. It's not, you invented
it's not,
it.
It's no, yeah. I didn't actually. My friend Chuck Spinney, that was a Pentagon term that was that he popularized, that at the Pentagon they would have weapon systems and, you know, jobs that were the self-licking ice cream cone. But I like that. But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. And so when you look at that and you say, okay, you know, there was no central planning. People didn't really totally understand what they were doing. At first, and they didn't have any technical wherewithal to know what they were doing before they did it. And here we are, you know, and it part of that also has to do with the structure of the American Constitution, you know, and the way interstate commerce has worked as, you know, a legal principle, and just the way in which the states are so empowered in their dealings with the federal government.
Right.
You know, and that's part of why we have the system that we have now. It sort of all spools out of that. And yeah, it is amazing that that works. You know, I'm thankful for that every day because it is wild.
Yeah, I agree. The complexities of the system, you know, the different voltages, the different policy entities, the different regulatory entities, the different types of generation, the enormous scale of the system, how many, you know, 6.1 million miles of wire, you know, 240,000 miles of high voltage transmission. And yet somehow it all sings from the same hymnal and it all is remarkably still reliable. But I fear, and I think this is the part that I talked about with Meredith Angwin recently on the, for this podcast, was that no one ultimately is responsible for the reliability. And therein lies the big worry that I have about where this ends up, right? And this is what happened after Winter Storm Uri here in Texas. Everybody's looking around, well, why did this happen? Well, oh, blame him. Oh, well, it was the system. It was the market fail. Well, why did the market fail? Well, it was a bad market, bad system design. But ultimately, there was no, as in the vertically integrated utilities, where you could put the CEO in the dock and say, you and your company didn't provide power. Why not? And now we're evolving into a system where there is no, the buck doesn't stop anywhere. How do you think about that?
You know, I think that that's just structurally true for the RTOs. They're just built in a way where nobody has that. You know, I was thinking about, who did you had this guy on a while. Jason Fordney.
Yeah.
From, what
California,
is it? Energy Markets or something like that.
Yeah,
CEM.
Right, yeah.
Great guy. Love his coverage. Learn a lot from him.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he brought up and that was ramified for me in Catherine Blunt's book about PG&E is he was like, look, you have some of these like felonious entities that just don't go away. You know, like PG&E has killed people multiple times, you know, like that's just what's happened. So I think, where am I going with that? What I want to say is that, can the public really tell the difference between what accountability looks like at a monopoly utility, if it's going to be like that, versus how it works at an RTO? I don't know. At the ground level, it's actually hard for me to tell.
Right.
So you can say like, oh, this CEO will get hurt. It's sort of like, dude, no one knows except for nerds like us who the CEO of any given utility is.
Right.
You know, like how many people in America know that Jeff Lyash is the CEO of the TVA in this country? Like vanishingly few. At a population level, right? So
if you put me on the spot, I don't think I can name a single CEO of a single utility in America.
Right. So that's sort of my point. It's sort of like, you know, responsibility is important, even if people don't see it, but it's also really important that people see it to feel like they can have faith in the system. So maybe we just have bad incentives all around, right?
Right.
You know, here's a quote. One time somebody asked Stalin, they said, which is worse, a left-wing capitalist turn or a right-wing capitalist turn for our society? And he said, both are worse. You know, maybe, you know, both of these are worse. You know, what's the right way? I don't know. The question I'm going towards now is, because our grid is so balkanized and we might see power markets grow, certainly they're growing westward and stuff like that. The question might not be, how should this thing overall be governed, but how should these specific portions be governed in order to be most accountable? Because all of them have different weather, generation profiles, yeah, legacy, infrastructure, you know what I mean? Like, maybe that's the better question. That's also a harder series of questions to answer in a way, because it's all one size fits all, or because it's not one size fits all. And that's what I wonder. You know, I don't believe, I would say one of the things that has changed over my coverage of Grid Brief is that I think I used to be more sympathetic to the monopoly framework than I am now, because that is the framework in which nuclear energy has succeeded.
Right.
But if I think about the grid and not just what the generators are, like, the grid is what it's supposed to be doing for society, I care less, frankly, about nuclear than I do for the system's success.
Right.
You know? And so I wonder, you know, is that level of accountability really there? It takes a lot for a utility to A, go bankrupt, and B, really feel the pain for its own consequences. And I think James Krellenstein made the excellent point on Decouple a few months ago, where he said, you know, some utilities are scared to invest in nuclear because it's one of the only things that's actually successfully killed utilities in America because of cost overruns and stuff like that.
Right.
Right. And that just goes to show you how much pressure it takes to actually get one of these things to pay for malinvestment or whatever it is. And that's what we would see as consequences for irresponsible action, right? For misallocations in that. So when people say, you know, the big difference between the monopoly and the RTO is responsibility, I'm saying I don't feel as confident about that insertion as I used to at all.
That's a really good point. And, you know, because Meredith made this point, she, about this very issue, right? We were talking about whether electricity is a service or a commodity. And she said, you know, that people accuse her, well, you're just in favor of monopolies. And she said, well, no, I'm not in favor of monopolies. I am in favor of accountability. But look at PG&E. They've gone bankrupt twice, right? In the past 20 or 25 years, I forget. Has any of their executives gone to jail because of all the people that were killed because of the fire? Well, no. Is their service any better? Well, probably not. Are their prices any lower? No, their prices are skyrocketing. But right. I think your point too about this governance issue around the grid, that now it's become so complex. The system has become so complexified, and that it's going to have to be managed and continue to be managed more in a regional manner than in a national manner, even though doing it at a national level might be more sensible. That maybe to, you know, I'll ask you, is it just simply because it's become so unwieldy, no one's going to be able to be that smart to figure out how to do it all together?
So here's a question I started to ask myself. You know, I used to be a socialist and very far on the left. And one of the questions that you'd ask yourself if you're doing any sort of organizing is like, okay, what do you want? And then it's like, who else wants that? How many people? And then what is it going to take those people to get what they want?
Right.
You know, and then also, you know, it's a democracy. The enemy gets a vote, right?
Yeah. Right.
So what will it take to overcome them and then maintain power so that you can actually implement what you want? And once you start asking yourself a series of that, you start to realize why there's so much inertia around change.
Right.
How
difficult it is to make that change, right?
Yeah. And so I think take that, couple it with my, you know, ever-growing humility about how this thing actually runs. And then take a look at how fractious American politics is right now. You had H.W. Brands on. He was just like, yeah, it's always been this way, which he's right about.
Yeah.
You know, no one's getting shot to death in duels in Congress anymore, right? Yeah. So things have gotten a little bit better since the 1830s.
Although that could be helpful.
That could be helpful. Yeah, right, yeah.
And entertaining. You know, we got MMA. Why not duels? I mean, come on.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you see... Also, each of these actors has their own calculus for their cost benefit,
right?
Because they're all in different roles. So I'm not saying that there's no hope or nothing can be done, but usually Steve Isser, who's a very good sort of electricity policy historian, said, you know, this sort of goes crisis to crisis and then you muddle through.
Right.
And I think that that's just how this is going to go. You know, I want it to be a situation where I'm like, here's the answer. And this is what we're all going to rally around and fight for. But I just don't think that that's how this is going to play out for so many different reasons, you know.
I tend to agree. I think, you know, and that's the thing. Well, I mean, more broadly about American politics, right? That, you know, that somehow we're going to muddle through. And I had Dan Crenshaw on the podcast, and we just published that one recently. He's represents the 2nd District, 2nd Congressional District. And I said, what gives you hope? And he said, he ultimately said the Constitution. Then he said, you know, for 250 years, people have been trying to destroy America and they haven't succeeded. And it's just because the Constitution, the resilience of the system is so great. And that's my kind of gut as well, is that we have so many counterbalances in America, the diffusion of power, political power, economic power. And I think that's it's reflected in the grid. The grid in many ways is a perfect reflection of America in that regard, right? That it is, and I've said that before, grids reflect the societies that they power. You go to Lebanon, the grid doesn't work. There's all kinds of corruption. Well, hey, welcome to Beirut. You know, this is the way it works here, right? Whereas here in the Texas Hill Country, well, you got Pedernales Electric Cooperative, and next door you got Bluebonnet, and then you got the city of Austin, and you got, you know, it's all overlapping and it's all these different jurisdictions, but somehow it is amazing that we, you know, and that I tend to think so as well, that we're going to muddle through, but I fear that we could be very close to one or two catastrophic events where we have a meltdown and lots of people will die because of this lack of kind of cohesive thinking about the system as a system. I guess it'd be, you know, if I'm down to my brass tacks, that's where I think about this, the inability of policymakers to think about, no, we have a very complex system and we have to think about it as a system, but then that would require engineering thinking and we don't have that.
You know, we don't have that. I mean, hey, we don't even have enough alignment right now.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like it's down to simple stuff like that. So how's that going to work at a policy level? I mean, you know, God, the idea of being like, okay, here's how the power market actually works. And there are people who are obviously, you know, I mean, he's taking off now from his time in the Senate, Joe Manchin. Whenever he would engage with FERC, it was clear that he was very well apprised of certain power issues and stuff like that. But that's also because he's on a Senate committee that is supposed to inculcate that level of expertise in senators, not House reps, by the way.
Yeah.
And that is always how it's supposed to be, right? That is the, you know, to be redundant, the senatorial aspect of the Senate.
Right.
It's supposed to be more senior in all sorts of ways, which isn't to say that House committees don't matter or whatever, but the way people rotate in and out of the House, it's just not the same type of thing. So I think that it's possible to get some motivated policymakers. I think it might be possible to have a motivated activist presidential cabinet for stronger appointees at like the NRC and perhaps even FERC or whatever to do some of the stuff. But again, it's not going to be command control. All these states have their own energy policy act, environmental policy acts, like their own version of NEPA. They all have their own renewable portfolio standards.
And cities and towns. Berkeley, California, Austin, Texas. Oh, we got a climate policy here. You know, okay, so how is that all going to work? But
that all has to get worked out somehow. So I think that there are a lot of obstacles, and I think we are at the beginning of this conversation.
Mm, yeah.
This is the beginning of the conversation about America's power grid. This is a 5 to 15 year conversation.
Right. about how how the grid has matured and how we want to shape it in the future to make it more reliable. Yep. And also I think how we fit nuclear into that equation, because I've been,
yes, sir.
I think like you, adamantly pro-nuclear, but I am very sober about the prospects. And especially now with, let's call it what it is, the failure of NuScale to get that project built with UAMPS and in Idaho. And now just look at their stock price, right? You know, they're down, you know, they were at $10 or $12 at the beginning of 2023. Now they're $2 and change. They just laid off 40% of their workers. You know, there's a real possibility that NuScale goes bankrupt, right? You know, that this is going to be one of the casualties on the road toward this new nuclear paradigm, that they're going to be casualties and it's going to be bloody, because it's not going to be cheap, simple, or easy. And then just the reality of it.
Yeah. I mean, that was really tough to watch, you know, what happened there. And it made sense. Like, these are all, you know, I took a pretty close look at that situation. And, you know, for a bunch of rural utilities, even if they're all putting it in together, you know, it made sense that they were gun shy about what the overages were going to be and what they could even afford to plow into their rate base.
Yeah.
You know, it made complete sense. And that's what made that hard to watch.
Yeah. NuScale today is at $2.08. That's the latest. Down 4% today. It's down 80% for the year. The year to date, over the last 1 year, it's down 80%. Went public at $10 in 2020 and now trading for $2 and change.
So, yeah, that's gut wrenching. So yeah, I mean, I think,
but this
I think
is, that's but this be- is part of the casualties of the system that we live in, right? This is the capitalist nature. This is the capitalist system. And they're going to have to try and make it in these markets where there's no, the government isn't going to necessarily press the scale on their favor. And that was, to take more robust government backing. I think it's very clear.
It depends on what shape that backing takes. So I talked to some people about what was going on with NuScale, and it's not like the Inflation Reduction Act isn't generous to nuclear. Right. They're willing to cover half of a lot of stuff. You know, the IRA has a lot of stuff that people haven't even worked out how to make work unlock for them. So maybe there is a robust level of government backing there for that type of thing. And it just hasn't been like lawyered out enough where people don't know how to access it or whatever. I'm going to have to plead humility on how that works, because I'm not in those conversations and I still don't understand everything that's in that bill.
Yeah,
and I don't think anybody in the industry does, you know? So enough government backing, there might be. And I mean, we're even seeing now, I was reading something the other day, you know, because they didn't secure permitting reform as they promised Joe Manchin that they would after passage of the IRA, plenty of these projects are just going to die on the vine. They're never going to happen.
Right.
Because no amount of subsidy is going to overcome how expensive it is to build any goddamn thing in this country.
Right. Yeah. Right. Or overcome local opposition.
So, also, why should tax dollars go towards just like hiring a ton of lawyers? That sucks. Yeah. Like, I don't want to, like, my politics these days is just decreasing the power and importance of the legal profession in America.
Yeah.
Like, how do we do that? You know?
Yeah. Get started.
Yeah.
So we've been talking for nearly an hour. And again, my guest is my friend, Emmett Penny, who has already gained fans for his appearance in the docuseries, the upcoming docuseries, Power Politics and Juice, Power Politics and the Grid. But I wrote this down earlier. I'm going to ask you about what are you reading and what gives you hope, because that's what I always do. But you said that earlier that getting sober was spiritually humbling, and that writing Grid Brief was and understanding energy was intellectually humbling. I know you've been sober for a long time. It's what, 10 years, 12 years now?
I think it'll be 14 in February. Yeah.
14 years next in February. If you don't mind, you volunteered this, but can you talk about that? Because my dad got sober before he died, and you know, that history is dear to me, and people who go through that, they come out changed. But how do you correlated those two things about spiritually humbling and intellectually humbling? So you were already had kind of seen what needed to happen in terms of your own approach to your life when it came to the intellectual part of this. You equated the spiritual and the intellectual humbling together. Why?
Well, I think one thing that I learned, somebody told me a long time ago, That they had met, they'd never met anyone too dumb to get sober, but they definitely met people who were too smart.
But the ego, the ego prevented them.
Right. Which told me that a lot of my intellectual acumen was not going to be helpful to me in that domain. Uh-huh. And right. If anything, needed to kind of like be ignored a little bit. I had a penchant to overthink, and usually overthinking led to thinking about me because that was my favorite thing to think about. And that only made my life miserable. You know, more miserable. So I think that's sort of what I mean there. You know, I've had many humbling intellectual experiences over the course of my life, but as far as one that has been as sustained and pronounced as Grid Brief, that's been rare. Mm. And
but the more you don't know, the more you find you don't know.
Well, and that it is also sort of anybody who has recovered from anything, drugs, alcohol, whatever, will tell you that it has this ripple out effect over your entire life. And I've experienced that ripple out effect in covering Grid Brief. Because now I look at any issue, could be foreign policy, and I'm like, if this is anywhere near as complicated as the grid, then I have no idea what the fuck is going on. Pardon my French. I don't know what the hell is going on here. And I could have an opinion about it, and that's fine. You know, first of all, who needs to hear it? Right. So it's made me, I post a lot less now because I'm like, well, I don't know. What do I know? You know, so I think it's sort of done that. And it has.
So if Chinese American relationships are complicated, the relations are complicated. If it's as complicated as the American grid, I'm out.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, I could probably learn more about that, but now I know what it takes to actually learn enough to feel like you have a handle on it, you know? And so I think that that's what I meant when I was talking about that, you know, is that, and that also has an impact on the rest. It hasn't had an impact on the rest of my life where I'm just way, way more prudent about what I think may or may not be the case, you know, and I don't always perfectly live up to that, especially if I get a wild hair up my ass and I'm feeling kind of squirrely and I want to be mad about something, you know, like I can pop off maybe irresponsibly. I'm human. I think for the most part is that it has made me subject a lot of my own assumptions to more rigorous critique. And to the extent where, you know, even a year ago, I was writing way more heated things about the environmental movement. And I'm sort of like done doing that. So we began this conversation talking about it. Yeah. And I have many critiques of it, but I am done being angry and trying to villainize people. And instead I'm trying to like understand what this thing is trying to solve, which is why I've been going back and reading like canonical environmental works. So, you know, I've done Aldo Leopold, I've done Rachel Carson. Now I'm doing Schumacher. I'll be moving on to like Whole Earth Catalog, Amory Lovins and Lewis Mumford next. And that's because what I've realized is that it behooves you to really know.
Right.
If you want to have more than an opinion, you need to really know. And so then you need to be patient. And you need to be humble and you need to understand why things resonate.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. The next question, what are you reading? You said you're reading Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher, published in 1971. Is that right? Something like that? 1970?
Yeah. 73, actually. I think it came out 72 or 73. So right in there, you know, I also learned that he met with Jimmy Carter before PURPA. As Amory Lovins did. Yeah. So that's the more you know. Also, you get little chestnuts like that, right? When you read this stuff. So I learned that from Bill McKibben, of all people, because of the foreword he wrote to the book. So thanks, Bill. I know you're a big fan of Power Hungry and listen all the time.
Yes.
Famously willing guest of Power Hungry, Bill McKibben. Right now I'm reading that. I am reading The Field of Blood by Joanne Freeman, who is a great historian. It is her book on the faction and violence in Congress in the years and decades leading up to the Civil War, and then I think a little bit during the Civil War. And what I love about it is that it really relies on the diaries of the House Secretary or something like that, this guy Benjamin Frank. And so he's got all of these great— he was a meticulous diarist. So you have all of these great, like, ground level looks at John Quincy Adams. And, you know, he was there when John Quincy Adams had his stroke and then eventually died in the House. And then he was there to comfort Mary Todd Lincoln after Lincoln was assassinated. So he saw a lot. And it's not just all based on, she's a serious historian. She's not just transcribing his diaries, right? She's doing her own work and interpretation. But it's been a great book so far. I'm getting more and more interested in that period of American politics. So that's my before bed intellectual project reading. I am finishing up Leo Marx's The Machine in the Garden, Technology and the Pastoral Ideal in America. And my friend John and I are doing a reading series on that for Nuclear Barbarians. And that's been very eye-opening in terms of seeing how we have articulated and conceived of our relationship with the natural world and technology from the early days of the American Republic till about the 1950s, because he publishes that book, I think, in about 55. So that's been very eye-opening and helpful. And is there anything else I'm reading? I've been picking my way through, mostly for quotes because of my own writing, Samuel Insull's memoirs, which has been, which is a completely disorganized and kind of boring book, but every once in a while, there's something really worthwhile in there. And I love reading letters or diaries from historical figures, because I feel like you can really, you know, I wrote a very long piece about David Lilienthal. And one of the great joys of researching that piece was reading his journals, where he's like, you know, I was sitting behind FDR at church, you know, the other day. And you're like, this is crazy to be reading somebody who was that close to history, you know? So,
And Lilienthal, for those who don't know, was the head of the Tennessee Valley Authority in the early days, and then was the first head of the Atomic Energy Commission. Is that right?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for that book list. I knew you'd have an interesting one. What gives you hope?
You know, so I would say what gives me hope these days is that I feel like there's no real other option in terms of how to live a life. I've lived with great levels of despair in my life. And it wasn't worth it. It was never worth it. I never learned more when I was in a place of despair. I never felt like I could do anything that was helpful in a place of despair. I never felt like my life, as just my personal life, was achievable when operating from places of despair. So to me, the only option is hope, because that's how my forefathers, everybody that has come before me, has woken up and said, I'm going to try to do this day because I have to do this day, and it's incumbent on me to do this as the best version of myself that I can, right? Broad scale, what gives me hope is that I don't know what happens next. You know, I spend a lot of time reading history now. It has a nasty way sometimes of surprising you, but also a beautiful way.
Mm.
You know, and I think change is always possible. Here's a great example from history that has been very inspiring to me lately. This is the Confederate General Longstreet. He was, you know, one of Lee's right-hand guys. A lot of people don't know this about him, but he was so taken by Grant's generosity in the Confederate defeat that he became an advocate for Black civil rights in Louisiana when he became governor, and fought to make Reconstruction happen. And then eventually, I think he eventually had to leave the South because of that. I can't remember the exact story, but it cost him dearly to do that. He was seen as a betrayer, but he thought it was the right thing to do, that that was his duty. That's an amazing story to me. That is a human capacity for change and redemption that deserves long meditation.
Yeah, that's interesting. Here, I'm just looking up James Longstreet. Confederate general under Lee. That's interesting. I didn't know that history. But became an advocate for civil rights in the wake of this. I mean, essentially
during Reconstruction.
During Reconstruction, and clearly failed. Right, it took another 100 years for that to happen.
To go from the Confederate general to doing that is no small thing. You know, I don't know where that puts his life on balance, but to me, that level of change is just incomprehensible and gives me hope.
Yeah. Well, in the number of battles, I'm just looking at all the things that he did during,
He was the real deal too. He was no rear echelon general. He was out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Well, we will stop there. I thought we'd make this a little shorter today, but you know, when you and I get talking, Emmett, we keep going. So my guest has been my friend, Emmett Penny. He is the editor of Grid Brief. You can find that on gridbrief.com. He's also the host of the Nuclear Barbarians podcast. You can find that on all, wherever fine podcasts are found, as well as on Substack. Emmett, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming on the Power Hungry podcast and for being one of the stars of the upcoming, or the now out, I think we're going to release this after the podcast or after the docuseries comes out, the new docuseries, Juice, Power, Politics, and the Grid.
Well, thanks you for having me here and for having me in the doc, Robert. That's all you.
And all you out there in podcast land, thanks for tuning into this episode of the Power Hungry podcast. Until next time, see ya.